The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesnik. I'm viewing WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest the author Tom Frank. Frank is the founding editor of the Baffler magazine. He's a PhD in American history from the University of Chicago, which he earned in 1994. And he has written three books. His first book, The Conquest of Cool, based on his dissertation. His second book, One Market Under God, which came out a few years ago, in which we spoke with Tom on the air on Media Matters a couple of years ago. And then now his new book, which we'll be talking about today, What's the Matter with Kansas? Tom Frank, as many of you are probably familiar, writes frequently for Harper's, The Nation, and The Baffler, of course, the magazine that he has helped as founding editor. Tom, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob.
Well, it's really a pleasure, and I want to let our listeners know right off the top that we're taping this show a couple of days before it goes on air because I have to be out of town on Sunday. So today, just sit back and let Tom and me do the yakking, and don't call in, just enjoy yourselves. And Tom, let's just start right at the top. You know, why did you write this book, and what is the matter with Kansas?
The title is... It refers to an essay written a really long time ago. It uses Kansas metaphorically. It's both about things that are going on in Kansas, and it's also about Kansas as the sort of most average place in America, the kind of, you know, the heart of America. And this is a kind of journalistic technique of long standing. Whenever people want to do stuff about the, you know, examine the soul of America, they go to Kansas
Or Peoria.
Yeah, that's right. There's several places. Another is Rockford.
In Dayton, Ohio.
Yeah.
They're all in the Midwest.
And, well, there's
one
more, Muncie, Indiana. This is where that book Middletown was about Muncie. And these are all thought to be places that you can evaluate as a microcosm of America. So my object was that, but it was also to examine a historical phenomenon that I've been interested in for a really long time, and to put it in a single word, that phenomenon is the backlash. The backlash is populist conservatism, something that basically didn't exist before about 1968, and since then has become the dominant note in American politics. And this is conservatism that speaks of itself as the voice of the marginalized and the little people and the downtrodden. This is George W. Bush's style of conservatism, Ronald Reagan's style of conservatism, and to a lesser degree, Richard Nixon's. It's, you know, it comes out of the Wallace campaigns in the 1960s and has since grown to become the phenomenon that we know and love today. And in Kansas, it's all over the place. This is a state where the backlash is just running wild. And so what I thought,
if I can remember, were candidates who espouse these sort of views, backlash politics, are winning elections hand over fist.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And exactly. And so it's a way of. So I want to examine the idea of the book is to examine the backlash in a level that's more close up than what, you know, than just writing about, you know, George Bush and his shortcomings. I want to write about the people that vote for George Bush. I want to examine the things that they think and the things that have caused them to sign up with the Republican Party, and not just the Republican Party, but the far right wing of the Republican Party. And to do that, you got to choose an area and focus and zero in on it. And since Kansas is my home state, and also this, you know, mythic home of the average man, the common man, I figured that was the place to go.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was talking to a colleague of mine a few years ago who's Canadian, and this is back at the University of Wisconsin. He was he's from a working-class background, and he went back to his hometown, I think it was Winnipeg, and he was talking about how he was in a bar, and he was talking with some people in his neighborhood, and they were spewing out all sorts of anti-labor union talk, and he was sort of taken back by it. And he came back to me and said, "Boy, you know, the world's really in, you've got some real problems in this country, talking about Canada, but I think he also meant the United States, when you've got poor people making rich people's arguments for them." And I thought of that as I read your book, because the recurring theme that comes through, What's the Matter with Kansas, is how you have this populist movement of sorts, this conservative popular movement, which is really, as you point out repeatedly, its economics are very hostile to the very interests of the people pushing the movement along.
This is true, and if you think about it in the big picture, in a big picture sense, you know, what's moved America to the right, and what's moved the world to the right, and what's allowed the sort of the whole politics of what they call in Europe neoliberalism, but deregulation, privatization, deunionization, and with it the stock market bubble and the huge divide between rich and poor, and all the things that go along with this, the destruction of manufacturing enterprises and the job insecurity and the lack of health care, all these things that go along with neoliberalism have happened because of the success of this right wing populist movement, because working class people increasingly vote Republican. That's what's allowed this to happen over the last 30 years. And then in Kansas, you can find often very, very specific cases of people voting against their own interests, especially in the agricultural sector, and you'll find working class people who are militantly against public education, for example, or who believe, you know, to the core of their soul that price supports for farmers should be shut down, you know, and they vote for, you know, for a party that's gung-ho for deregulation of this industry and that, and then these, you know, and then they watch as their small towns are destroyed by Walmart and, you know, Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and stuff like this, and it just makes them angrier still. And
yeah, I mean, one of the ironies that comes through in the book repeatedly and eloquently and at times brilliantly is that as these politicians get elected who espouse the backlash sentiment, we're going to talk a lot more about what's in that backlash sentiment in a second, but as these politicians get elected and as these movements are successful politically, the actual conditions, the living standards in the state of Kansas are plummeting. I mean, the state's really, if you get outside the affluent counties, is more or less in free fall.
That's right, and this is the case everywhere. This is what's one of the reasons that I chose to study Kansas, is it has all your different elements of society. It has, you know, the small towns which are out on the plains anywhere, depopulating, and they're emptying out, and the local businesses are all gone. You know, you put in a Walmart and it's like a neutron bomb. It kills every business for, you know, 40 miles or whatever the radius is. People have studied this, and you know, those areas, it's disaster out on the plains. And then there's a city of Wichita, which is an industrial city. It's like a miniature version of what Detroit used to be like. Mm-hmm. They build airplanes. There's, you know, four different airplane manufacturers there, and they're going through right now what Detroit went through in the 1970s. With the businesses are, you know, they're doing everything they can to get rid of the unions and to get out of town, to become flexible and all this sort of thing. And Boeing is really treating them badly right now. There's a lot of unemployment. And then you've got the suburbs of Kansas City, which are very affluent. And this is where Sprint is located. And they've hitched their wagon to the star of telecom, you know, and the new economy industries. And guess what? They're doing really, really well. And so you've got your, you know, all the different corners of the economic spectrum. And what's fascinating to me, though, is that the conservative revolt in the state, and that's what it's been for the last 10 years, there's this conservative uprising in Kansas, comes from the people who are hardest hit by all these changes, not from the comfortable. It comes from the people who are angry and bitter and, you know, in danger of losing their jobs,
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Tom Frank today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Tom Frank is the author of the brand new book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America, just coming out on June 1st. So it's not even in the stores yet, so make your plans to get a copy by Metropolitan Books. Those of you who've read Tom Frank's earlier books, One Market Under God or The Conquest of Cool, know that Tom Frank is one of the truly great writers of our generation. We're fortunate to have him with his new book, which I've had the privilege of reading the last few days, here on Media Matters with us today. This is not a live show. I'm taping it a couple days before we go on air because I'm going to be out of town on Sunday. So please don't call in. Just sit back and listen to the show and enjoy Tom's analysis. Tom, you know, let's talk about the appeal of the conservative ideology, because I think that's a lot of what your book is about. I mean, what chord seems to resonate with it attracts people. And you a lot of the book goes into this, and you talk about it. Is it plenty plaint? I mean, I'm not, how do you pronounce that? It's this term
plenty
I saw.
Plenty plaint. I don't know. I saw it on a pack of gum, you know.
Okay.
The plenty pack. I think that's like, you know, a Juicy Fruit or something. And what I meant by that is the first half of the book is just a description of the conservative revolt in Kansas and how, you know, you have economic conditions that 100 years ago would have, and in fact did, spell left-wing revolt and caused, you know, very predictably caused this kind of left-wing uprising in Kansas.
I mean, Kansas was the center of the agrarian left-wing revolt in the country.
That's right, 100 years ago. And and in conditions very similar to what is going on now. But today, it's the opposite. And let me just give you one more fact before I go on to answer your question, and that is the poorest county in America. It's in Nebraska, but it's just, you know, just north of Kansas. It's in a similar situation. It's one of these counties out on the high plains. It's seeing depopulation and seeing the, you know, the farming industry, farming and the industries that are supported by farming being destroyed. This county went for George Bush by 80%. And so did, you know, lots of other counties in the same predicament. This is the phenomenon that we're talking about here, is working class republicanism. Anyhow, so what I did was I tried to immerse myself in this culture. You know, I'd spend all this time in Kansas City reading their literature, going to their meetings, reading their magazines, reading their books especially, and trying to get to the bottom of the way that, you know, try to understand the way these people look at the world. And let me just get one thing out of the way right at the start, and that is that people on the left and people in the media tend to dismiss this kind of populist conservatism by just saying, well, these people are racists. There's just no talking to them. They're, you know, they've got a problem, and we just brush it off. We don't tend to think about it.
You know, and certainly, just to interrupt while you're making your tangential point here, because it's so important. I mean, as you pointed out, the George Wallace antecedents of this movement were all based in race.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And there was, in the early days of the backlash, it had a really ugly racial side to it. With Wallace and in the and this is all over the South. I mean, this is how the South went from being solid Democratic to being solid Republican. And this was also the case in things like the Boston busing riots, which were an important chapter in the, you know, the early days of the backlash. But this isn't the case in Kansas. And this is one of the reasons that it was so fascinating to me that there is no or very little you know, racist sentiment, even coded racist sentiment that I was able to find, and this goes way back in the, you know, in the history of the state. It's just not an Alabama kind of place. It just isn't. But anyhow, so it's a place. In my opinion, you have to take this stuff seriously. You can't just brush it off by saying, well, you know, it's a lot of. A lot of hicks with racist views, and once you get that out of the way, and you decide to take it seriously, you have to look at their ideas, and their, you know, their ideas about the world are very interesting, Bob. Let's put it that way.
Well, I'm an expert at them after reading your book.
Yeah, and you referred to what got me started on this long roundabout rant is you referred to what I call the plenty plaint. And the first thing you got to realize about populist conservatism is that these people are dissenters, just like you and I are, but in a very different way. They feel very uncomfortable in the modern world and in living in America, and they complain about every little thing around them. They're very, very touchy, and they find evidence for what's wrong with the world in the littlest things. I remember how this first came to my attention was when I was in high school in Kansas City. There was a local newspaper that ran a had a column where you could phone in, and you could phone in and just leave a message on their answering machine, and they would print it verbatim in the paper. And people were forever calling in and saying, you know, there's a guy down the street from me that doesn't mow his lawn right. And this is somehow connected to him being a liberal. It's because of liberalism that he doesn't mow his lawn right. Or somebody cut me off in traffic today. You know, liberalism, damn it. Or, you know, somebody doesn't fly their flag the right way. And this is 'cause, you know, liberals. And it's the weird thing that you find is that almost everything in the world pisses these people off. And they it all comes back to liberalism. And what I'm sort of making a very, very long story really, really short here, but what you find the weirdest thing about all this populist conservatism is that it's descended from a kind of old school leftism. Well, the kind of leftism that when I was in graduate school, we used to call vulgar Marxism, the sort of 1930s-style Marxism, only with all the economics drained out. Mm-hmm. So they use the same language to describe liberals that a sort of a writer for the Daily Worker would have used to describe capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the same beefs with the world that old school leftists used to have. Like they're very suspicious of the media. They're very suspicious of higher education. But instead of seeing the thing that distorts, you know, that distorts these institutions, that distorts the news, and that makes higher education so awful, instead of blaming the power of business for it, or capitalism or whatever, they blame liberals. Just liberals. Liberals do this. Why do liberals do it? Well, that's a good question. Nobody really has a good answer for that. But everything comes back to liberalism.
And what are the issues that really fire up the engine? What are the big complaints that the conservative populist activists have?
Well, now this is your listeners are going to be familiar with the term culture wars, mm-hmm. and this is really what it is. Just culture wars in hyperdrive. The idea is that these cultural battles. This is sort of the basic maneuver of the backlash, is that these cultural battles far outweigh economic self-interest. And the conservatives are very, very good at coming up with cultural issues that mobilize people in a way that their economic interests do not. And they each of these issues they're able to convince their followers that the cultural issue in question is so important that it really does outweigh everything else in their life. And abortion is the most obvious example of this.
It seems like abortion in Kansas in particular played a central role in galvanizing conservatism.
Yeah, it did. It was in 1991, there was a group called Operation Rescue, which you might remember from the 80s, that they invented a lot of really aggressive tactics that they would use against abortion clinics. They would sit on the ground around an abortion clinic. They would chain themselves to fences. They would get in front of cars. They would do stuff like this. And they decided at some point that the way to do this was to select a single city and then go to that city and kind of like a general strike sort of thing, just paralyze the city. And they chose Wichita for this, Wichita, Kansas, back in 1991. It was an interesting choice because Kansas is a very religious place. It was then, and it's even more so now, I guess. But it also was ahead of the crowd on women's rights. Kansas was one of the states that had reformed its abortion laws before Roe v. Wade. It had, they had women's suffrage there very early on. I think they had the first female mayor of any city in the country was in Kansas. But this is a long time ago. Anyhow, Wichita had an abortion clinic, still does, that performs late-term abortions. And so these people descended on Wichita to try to bring these two aspects of the Kansas identity into conflict with each other, the progressivism on women's rights and then the religiosity. And they were very successful. They were all over the city and, made a huge splash, and I interviewed many people who this was like an awakening to them when they went down to Wichita to help protest at this thing. And it's funny because the state's the moderate leaders of the state were just horrified by this, by what happened. The activists called it the Summer of Mercy in 1991 when they all showed up there, and the state's leaders were horrified by the Summer of Mercy. They just, this was like the worst thing ever, and they, you know, it was very embarrassing to them. But for the conservatives in the state, this was it was a galvanizing experience, and it really mobilized them. Starting from there, they started recruiting people to take over the Republican Party from the precinct level up. And they, by 1994, they were successful, and they controlled the Republican Party in the state. They had taken it away from the sort of old guard, moderate leaders, and they had managed to elect a number of their own people to the state's highest office, as congressmen, mm-hmm. and U.S. senators and that kind of thing. And that's where it got its start, was that issue.
We're talking to Tom Frank today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Thomas Frank is the author of the brand new book, just coming out June 1st, called What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. That's what we're talking about this hour. This is a show we taped a couple days before going on air, so please don't try to call in today. Sit back, listen, and enjoy. We're talking about right now the rise of the conservative populist movement in Kansas, a sort of an example of the movement really nationally, nationwide. And one of the themes that comes through in the book that you talk about, which is sort of a central issue now in American politics, is the split between what you call the mods, the old-fashioned Republicans who were more interested in sort of like a different set of issues, certainly not extreme by any means ideologically, on one hand, and the conservatives, the new sort of populist right-wing complaint backlash folks.
Yeah.
And the real sort of, there's a class split there, as you talk about. We'll talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, that's the mods are the mods are definitely the upper class, the traditional rulers of the state, the moderate Republicans, and this is the Bob Dole type of Republican. And this is, by the way, I should say, this is a split that you see everywhere in the country. Just a month ago in Pennsylvania, you had this this showdown between Arlen Specter, and he had a challenger for his senatorial seat in the Republican primary. He was challenged by a conservative, an upstart. And in Kansas, the conservatives, the split between the mods and the cons is a class divide. And it's funny, this is very difficult for the media to talk about. And, class is always, it's a very uncomfortable issue for people in the media. And it's also, the moderates themselves don't like to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody likes to think that nobody likes to admit that they are the ruling class. That's very, that's very uncomfortable. And by the way, the Democrats, I should say, are really marginal in Kansas. It's a one-party state, and it pretty much always has been.
I think you said there hasn't been a Democratic U.S. senator since 1932.
Yeah, that's right. There hasn't been one elected. The only time that the Republicans were really out of power was during the 1890s, when you had the populist party showed up there and fused with the Democrats and managed to keep the Republicans out for quite a while. But that was the only time. Otherwise, they've been in power forever.
But it's a fragile relationship between these two sides of the Republican Party.
Oh, Bob, they hate each other.
It's
vicious. It's way beyond fragile. These guys are they can't stand each other. And when, they call each other terrible names, they're forever betraying one another. If one of their guys doesn't win in the primary, they'll often, go sulking off and vote for the Democrat, or they'll continue their campaign as a write-in in the general election. And when I interviewed, people on both sides of this divide, and they were forever telling me the most, outrageous stories about the people on the other team. None of them really care about Democrats, since Democrats are negligible in Kansas. But they just hate each other. And mm-hmm. as I said, the split is a sociological split. It's a split between it's a class divide. The moderates come from the wealthier neighborhoods.
I mean, the traditional Republicans when I was growing up.
That's right. And the conservatives come from the more working class neighborhoods. And they in the elections, the working class neighborhoods will generally go for the conservative candidates. And the conservative candidates, what's funny is, the while the moderates don't like to talk about this, the conservatives talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. They constantly talk about social class, and this is what makes it so fascinating. This is how this is the Republican appeal to working class voters, you know, right up close is what you see in Kansas, and that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, I think it's really an important issue that everyone's got to be concerned with. Is this great appeal? What is the basis of it?
Well, it's cultural issues. They have trouble. They would really have trouble selling themselves along economic lines. Both factions are agreed on the sort of fundamental issues for Republicans, which are they're pro-business, they're anti-union, they're pro-privatization, deregulation, lower taxes, all that stuff. Those aren't really discussed. Those issues mm-hmm. aren't part of the picture. Instead, they fight over cultural issues. And your moderate Republicans tend to be pro-choice. And they tend to have great faith in the public schools, and your conservative Republicans tend to be pro-lifers, and they also tend to, they hate the public schools. they don't like to say that very bluntly, but behind the scenes, they say the most outrageous things. They despise public education.
No, in fact, in the book, you have a hilarious section where you transcribe sort of a commentary on all these conservative listservs about public education, and I think they're going back and forth trying to outdo each other with who can trash it the most, and finally they agree on the term, but government indoctrination
centers,
they want to call schools.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you got to remember, Kansas had, when I was growing up, had very excellent public schools, and parts of it still do. The rich suburbs of Johnson County. And so the moderates, these are people who really believe in public education, but who believe in education generally. You know, they're very proud. They want their kids to go to Ivy League schools. This is considered a major achievement in Kansas City when your kid goes to a good college somewhere.
Back east.
Yeah, that's right. And this is, because obviously that's a central accomplishment for these kind of for people of this in this social status. You know, these are professionals,
mm-hmm.
And so they respect education. And the conservatives, on the other hand, generally don't have college degrees, and they don't really care about that stuff. And they see the whole thing as some kind of creeping totalitarianism. They aren't interested in it. And in one of the big flashpoints between these two sides a few years ago, and this one was made national headlines. This is when I really got interested in the Kansas story. Was the conservatives on the state school board decided it was time to pick a fight with the theory of evolution?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that got a lot of attention.
Yeah. Well, now they're doing it all over the country. Now they're doing it in Ohio. They're doing it in Florida. But Kansas was the first one, since the 1920s, to bring this issue up again. There's a lot of ironies, and it's fascinating. But one of the things that I want to point out about all these cultural issues that the conservatives, that they use to mobilize the conservative voters, is that they are impossible to win. These issues are incapable of being, of them. There was no way they were going to beat the theory of evolution in any mm-hmm. kind of real contest with, the science establishment. It's not going to happen. The idea is ridiculous. And the same is true of the abortion debate. They're not going to outlaw abortion in America without overturning Roe v. Wade, and that's not going to be that easy to do. Another great example of this, these kind of cultural battles that they choose, is the war over the Ten Commandments monuments.
Mm-hmm.
There was a judge down in, where was it? Was it Mississippi?
Was it Alabama?
I think it was Alabama.
Yeah,
the judge who put up this Ten Commandments monument in his courthouse, knowing full well, he was picking a fight with the ACLU, and it was a fight that he was going to lose. And everybody knew this from the get-go. He did it deliberately to stir up his followers and to sort of sharpen their feelings of persecution. And this is one of the central things about populist conservatism.
I mean, Tom, a cynic listening to this, or maybe a skeptic, would say, boy, this seems like a classic case of like these rich people, drumming up support on these sort of superfluous issues so people can blow off steam and get all fired up. Then they vote for candidates who will push through an economic agenda which will work against their interests.
Well, that sort of is what's what's going on. But, but I wouldn't say that these issues are chosen deliberately that way. This is, you know, I don't have any evidence that there's a conspiracy that's bringing mm-hmm. this about. But I can say that these issues, I mean, that this is a similarity. And
but you know, Tom, in your book, you know, I'm reading sections where you're going through all these sort of upper class pundits on the right,
yeah,
who are sort of like, you know, waxing eloquently about how great the common people are,
yeah, sort
of voting
yeah.
conservative. You know, and how their great morals and values and their concern with ethics. And these are people, you know, as you know, and you write about in the book, you know, their personal lives and their own beliefs have nothing to do with these so-called common people.
Right. Oh, of course. And while I said that there is this class split between the two sides of the Republican Party, the conservatives have their, you know, have a number of very wealthy people on their team as well. I mean, there's no shortage of millionaires, you know, for both factions of the Republican Party. And look, it's clear that this is the future of the Republican Party is to continue to appeal to this mass audience, to these people that, you know, back in the 30s would have been classic Democrats, you know, would have been hardcore Democrats. And, you know, they're winning these people over. You know, of course they're going to continue to do that. And, of course, there's going to be a lot of money and a lot of political strategy that goes into figuring these things out. And I should say also that the people who are choosing these cultural battles are canny people. They're career politicians. So there obviously is a great deal of choice that goes into it. And, mm-hmm. you know, the current Attorney General of Kansas, he's one of the conservatives, you know, he's a very intelligent man. And, you know, he's been on a number of national TV programs. He's sort of the toast of the conservative wing.
He's
right
been
now.
On the you Bill know, O'Reilly show, you said.
That's right. And he's a young man who's going places.
Yeah.
But as soon as he became attorney general, you know, he chose these issues to fight on. And the issues were, what were they? It's like homosexual rape or something like
yeah,
that.
Flag
and,
burning, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, they're issues that touch the lives of nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And they're things that have to, you know, that are just strict, they're strictly issues that are just for purposes of demagoguery. They,
mm-hmm.
they really have nothing to do with everyday life, with day-to-day life. They're just to get you mad.
This is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on AM 580 WILL. Today, our guest is Thomas Frank, author of the new book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. This is a show we tape a couple days before going on air, so please do not try to call in today. Tom, I mean, I think we've really gone a long time, and we've really missed, I think, a central theme of the book and of your argument, which is sort of the disappearance of class. And
yeah.
It's really underscoring the entire problem here.
Class is the central, you know, it's the central fact of this big split. Class is what divides the conservatives from the moderates. What's fascinating is that people don't talk about class as an economic phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about it as a cultural phenomenon. And they go on and on and on about the conservatives, and the Republicans generally go on and on and on about what they call the liberal elite. And you've heard this term before.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that liberal people are the elite of the country, and that they you can tell this because of their tastes and their, you know, where they went to college and stuff like this. So it's all about cultural choices that people make. I call this the latte libel.
Yeah.
It's always associated with latte, you know, that coffee drink that you get down at Starbucks or wherever. And this is and liberals are always said to be, you know, drinking lattes, and this is indicative of their way of looking at the world. I mean, this comes up wherever, whenever people are beating on the liberal elite, they'll start talking about lattes next thing you know.
Yeah, so economic inequality, the rule of business over our society, its domination of corporations over our life, basically falls entirely from view.
That's one of the themes that runs throughout the book. And this is true of the conservative movement in many, 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 many ways, that everything they do and all the appeals that they make all depend on not discussing economics. If they had to talk about economics, if you bring economics up, the whole thing, the whole structure falls apart. And so they're able to understand class as entirely a cultural phenomenon, entirely a matter of tastes and, you know, preferences, and not a matter of economics. And they're able to talk about any number of things in a similar way. For example, and this is one that you know a lot about, the whole liberal bias critique of mm-hmm. the media, where they say that the news is, you know, slanted the way it is. It's an economic critique with the economics left out, mm-hmm. or it's an old left critique with the economics drained out. It used to be really obvious to critics of the media that the media was controlled by publishers, by people who owned the media, and they were doing what they did in the interest of the advertisers. You know, this is an economic relationship. But for the conservatives, that's never part of the issue. That's never part of the equation. It's always about the reporters and the reporters' own, you know, class status. Like, did the reporter go to Harvard? Did the reporter go to, you know, where? And the reason they bring this up is because upper middle class people are supposed to not be religious enough or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's they talk about class all the time, but they never talk about the economics of class.
Mm-hmm. You know, it also seems like in the book, as I'm reading it, I mean, that part of the problem here comes from the other side, those who aren't Republicans at all, the Democrats who you criticize in the book, and also liberals. I mean, you know, to the extent that there is a liberal elitism, it plays right into this, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I was going to try to not talk about that because I know your listeners are they're good people, but they're going to be liberals, and I'm a liberal myself, and I have some, you know, some harsh words for my colleagues.
Well, we have a tough audience. Go ahead. Throw your best shots, Tom.
Okay. Very often liberals do play right into the stereotype. Let me skip over that for a minute.
Sure.
And talk about the Democratic Party on a national level, because
okay.
this really is their fault in some really important ways.
Yeah.
The Democratic Party walked away from working class voters and allowed all this to happen. You know, if they were still out there talking the same kind of language that they talked through most of their, you know, through most of the 20th century, these problems, you know, this wouldn't be happening. None of the stuff that's happened in the last 30 years would have happened. This is all or largely due to the shifts in the Democratic Party. And today the main, you know, you can go back and say what happened in the late 60s and you know, when the Democratic Party decided that it wanted to appeal to this group rather than that or whatever, but that's all, you know, ancient history. Nobody really it's not ancient history, but that's not the real problem. The problem today is I was just talking to there's a group here in Washington called the Democratic Leadership Council.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that gave you Bill Clinton.
The pro business part of the Democratic Party.
That's right. And their great idea is that they're dominant to a certain degree. I mean, it's you know, Al Gore was a member. Clinton, like I said, the chairman of the party is a member. Joe Lieberman, and Kerry is making his peace with them now. And their great idea is that the Democrats should give up on the economic issues. You know, try to limit the differences between themselves and the Republicans on economic issues, and instead fight it out over values issues. So
mm-hmm.
they've lost the thing that they, you know, the aspect of the party that used to appeal to working class voters, that is the economic issues. And you have, you know, examples of this would be NAFTA, which was, you know, a Republican scheme that Clinton signed on to, or welfare reform, or, you know, the general climate of deregulation that Clinton oversaw. You know, he was as pro-business as any Republican. And at the same time, they've shifted, you know, they've put all their emphasis on the social issues, you know, alienating these voters even more. So the problem is that they've basically lost this huge section of the electorate that used to be their base.
Tom, let me ask you this on that point. You know, we had on the show last week Arianna Huffington, who has a new book out, Fanatics and Fools, about the U.S. political situation. She argues that if Democrats were to seize the old mantle and talk about inequality and make that the central theme, that they would attract voters very quickly, that it would actually work. Do you share that?
Oh, yeah, of course, absolutely. Bob, the reason they look, there's the only reason they don't is because of the money in politics. There's, you know, the donations for Kerry would dry up overnight if he started talking like that.
Mm-hmm.
It would, you know, you could just all this money that they're raising for the 527s and that sort of thing, you can kiss it goodbye. That would be the end.
Mm-hmm.
This is the as long as your politics is completely beholden to money, then you're going to play the money game. There's no question about that.
You know, this reminds me, again, to interrupt, sorry about that, because it's your book we're talking about, but related to what you're talking about, I had a conversation once with a U.S. congressman named Sherrod Brown from Ohio, who's the leading Democrat who opposes all these trade deals, and he represents a working-class industrial district in northern Ohio, Lorain specifically.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about in 2000, right before the election, he was meeting with a bunch of workers at a factory in Lorain, and they were talking about the presidential election. And most of the men, and it was mostly men he was talking to, said they were going to be voting for Bush, even though they were union members, or a significant percentage of them. And Sherrod said, boy, I'm going to vote Democrat for Gore. And then one of the workers who was for Gore turned to the other members who were for Bush and said, how could you guys possibly vote for Bush? And one of the Bush people said, Bush is going to, Gore is against school prayer. Gore is for gun control. He's not our kind of guy. He's for gay rights. And someone said, well, Sherrod's for those things too. You're voting for Sherrod Brown to be your congressman. And the workers said, yeah, but Sherrod will fight for our jobs. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I don't look. I'm a liberal right down the line. And I don't share any of those. I'm for gun control. I'm pro-choice. I'm all of the above. You know, but it doesn't take a political genius to figure out that this is you've got to appeal that the working class is going to have the numbers, right? And you've got to figure out some way to appeal to these people, rather than just tossing them to the winds. The problem with the Democrats is that they want to remake themselves as the party of sophisticated businessmen. Have you ever read Richard Florida?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, the Rise of the Creative Class. This was his book, and
mm-hmm.
the Democrats have really embraced this idea of. You know, there's this big divide in the business world between the hip, enlightened CEOs, you know, who read The Management Theory, and you know, who talk about who talk about all the buzzwords and are very sensitive and all that stuff.
They have earrings.
Sorry.
Do they have earrings?
Yeah, that's right. And they allow people to wear casual clothes to the office. And then there's the other kind of CEOs that make everybody wear a suit and that, you know, work on Wall Street and do everything by the book. And the Democrats seem to think that that's the real divide in America. That's the real divide, and that's the line that they've got to take. Is they've got to appeal to those, you know, those nice, soft, hip CEOs rather than the hard old mean CEOs.
I was wondering, did you do any look at the empirical data as you're doing research for this book on relationship of voting preferences to economics, income levels? Because before I read your book, I was under the assumption that while, you know, working class support for right-wing politics certainly existed, that nonetheless, if you went down sort of an income chart of the United States, the higher up you went, the more likely you'd have people voting Republican. The further down, the more likely they'd vote Democrat. Is that no longer the case?
Well, I looked at things at the very top and the very bottom, and you've actually got Republicans at both ends.
Mm-hmm.
Both ends. I should say that I'm talking about this Republican appeal, the conservative appeal to working class voters. It's not universally embraced. Even in a state like Kansas, there are still pockets of strong Democratic support, generally wherever you have strong labor unions.
Yeah, that was really striking when you did talk about how basically being a union member changes the political equation dramatically.
Yeah, and I think the reason for that. Well, let me just describe to listeners what you're talking about.
Yeah,
that you can go down the demographic list and you take, well, say for example, white male voters, and in the last election they went by something like 60% for Bush or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you take that same voter and he's a union member, it's flipped. They went by 60% for Al Gore, and the same is true for women, or well, for every demographic group, that there's this substantial gap, you know, that the ones who, you know, there's a big difference. If they're members of a union, there's a lot more of them went for the Democrat. And you know, whether it's gun owners or whatever the case may be. And this is also true of casual union members, guys who don't have any contact with, you know, who don't go to the meetings and don't have any contact with the leadership. And I think the reason for this is just being aware of you know, what a labor union is and how it works gives you this sense that the economy is something you do have a say over and that you can control. And, you know, and that's the central issue that, you know, that's what conservative politics are all about, denying that, that economics are important. And now I was going to say something really, there are pockets in Kansas of, there are Democratic strongholds to this day in Kansas City, Kansas, and in Topeka and Wichita. But now the income thing, it's a very interesting point. As I said earlier, the very bottom counties, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, went Republican. The bottom four or five. But then you have a lot of others that went, and these are generally farm counties.
Yeah.
Then you have a lot of others that are Democratic. But then you get up to the high end, and the reason I looked all this up is because I was reading a essay by David Brooks about the red states and the blue states.
Yes, which you talk about at length in the book, and I think some of the most scintillating prose in the book concerning David Brooks, who is skewered, I might add, for our listeners' sake.
Yeah. It's not just Brooks, but there's a whole there's this analysis. I live in Washington, D.C. these days, and there's this whole analysis that people here really accept, which is that the country is divided into two, you know, the red states and the blue states, and they each have these sort of essential characteristics, and you know, we're like close to civil war, the red states versus the blue states. And the argument is that, and this is basically just the whole idea of a liberal elite, you know, writ large. So the blue states, or the Democratic states, are supposed to be the rich states, and the red states, which are the working class areas, are supposed to be Republican states. And there are a lot of people who will just say this right out: Republicans are the party of the working class. Now this is insane.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complete reversal of you know, of the whole, you know, of the last century of everything. It's a complete inversion of everything that we all assume to be true about politics. Now there is a grain of truth to it. You know, as I said, there are these very poor counties that went for Bush, and it is true that the, you know, your heartland states went for Bush, and that your East Coast states and California went for Gore. I mean, all that is obviously the case. But when you, and David Brooks says in his essay, at some point he just says it right out, that rich people everywhere voted for Al Gore. Well, if you, it's not correct. If you look into it, the richest county in America is Manhattan. And yes, it did go for Al Gore, but there are many millions of people in Manhattan. It's very hard to use that data to indicate anything. And if you go, you know, after you get past, I think Aspen is the second richest, but that's, you know, a small town, and that also went for Gore. But once you get below that, they're all Republican,
yeah,
or just about. All the wealthy suburban places, there are a few exceptions. I think Marin County in California went for Gore, but by and large, David Brooks even says that the North Shore of Chicago, the North Shore suburbs, the affluent North Shore suburbs went for Gore. This is simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they went for Bush by anywhere from 60% to 80%.
Mm-hmm.
Or the, you know, the area that where I grew up in Kansas City was the affluent suburb of Kansas City. That is, you know, where it's the moderate, it's the center of moderate Republican Kansas went for Bush by 75% or something. And what's fascinating to me is when you get out to a place like Kansas, you find this whole, you know, David Brooks is very good at mocking liberals for their tastes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they sip their white wine and they drive their Volvos and they drink their lattes and they do all these, you know,
they speak
loathsome
French,
blue,
yeah,
state things.
Yeah, speaking French.
Yeah, they speak French, that's right. Yeah. They do all these loathsome blue state things, and that's how we know that they are an elite and they are liberals and blah, 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 blah. You've heard this so many times. It's not. But what's funny is that you go to a place like Kansas where there are no liberals or very few liberals, right? And the same stereotype is used by the conservatives to describe the moderate Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So the moderates, you know, these are the people that first invented this crap back in the late 60s, you know, to get Nixon elected, and now all these stereotypes are being used against them. So
yeah, we've only got a couple of minutes left, Tom, and we're coming upon a big election this fall, a presidential election. In the 2000 election, the Republicans and George W. Bush swept not only Kansas, but I think the entirety of the Great Plains states, almost all of which I think share the situation going on in Kansas, which is a real collapse of standard of living in the rural areas, and a real crisis for the agricultural and rural communities. Yet the voting turnout rate for Bush was extraordinary. It has appeared like it will be a repeat this year.
It's hard to say. I don't think that, you know, there's been so many disasters in Iraq, especially. It's hard to see how people can remain impervious to that. But in the people that I studied, their conservatism doesn't arise from their, you know, from things that go on in foreign policy or even from wars that the U.S. fight. It comes from their everyday life and their disgust with what they call liberals and their disgust with the people on the coasts. And I think they're going to rally to Bush, for those reasons, they'll continue to. I sure hope that one of the really annoying things about writing a book like this is that you realize, how powerless you are to change the way things are perceived in America and the way things are done, Fox News keeps on chugging, mm-hmm. and their paranoid universe keeps turning. And it's basically impervious to to the kind of setbacks that we've seen in Iraq. They aren't, these things don't shock them, don't change their mind.
Yeah, and I should say that the end of the book, What's the Matter of Kansas, ends on a somewhat somber note. I mean, you paint a picture that's fairly stark and don't really present an easy button to push to get us out of there.
Yeah, well, let me put it this way. If it pays off for Republicans to make these people poor, right? And I'm using this kind of conspiratorial language intentionally just to make a point. It doesn't mean I really believe that it's all figured out that way. But if, as the economy hollows out and wages fall and, the Great Plains is depopulated, there are similar examples all over the country, and as good jobs are lost and unions are busted and utilities are deregulated and privatized, and all these things, as they happen, and the quality of life gets worse, and people are, and the gap between rich and poor goes away, and equality is destroyed. If these things cause people to vote for Republicans, to vote for conservatives, then the world is off its axis. Then something has gone deeply wrong, and there's no disincentive, to use market language. There's no disincentive for Wall Street to do these things anymore. If they screw us over and we reward them for it, then of course they're going to keep doing it. And
on that cheerful note, Tom Frank, I'm afraid we've come out of time. I want to thank Thomas Frank, the author of the new book, What's the Matter with Kansas, for joining us today in Media Matters, and we'll be back with you 1 week from today.
On WILL AM, we can devote time to news because you, our listeners, value it and support it with your dollars. This is listener-supported radio, and right now you can help us raise the money still needed to meet our June 30th fundraising goal. Mail a check to UIF, Friends of WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. And thank you. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms. The high in the lower 80s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low in the lower 60s and south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the mid-80s and south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour in the morning, increasing to around 15 miles per hour in the afternoon. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. Central Time, a Prairie Home Companion.